I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today I'll tell you why the cost of champagne is going through the roof and what you can drink instead. Plus, are you ready? I swear there's a cocktail that comes with a preserved human toe in it. I'll tell you whose toe it is and what on earth it's doing in a drink. In the early 60s, the world knew nothing of Mexican food. Then thanks to Diana Kennedy, that all changed. I'll introduce you to her today. But first, let's see what's in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're so happy to have Robert Poole back here at the market. Robert is a one-of-a-kind blackberry, boysenberry, youngberry, and loganberry grower from Redlands. And he comes in once a year, very short time of period of time. And today, Robert, you're back. You've got several kinds of berries. Let's talk about the berries you have today and what makes them so unique.
Well, the youngberry is the sweetest member of the blackberry family, and it's, for many people, a favorite blackberry. The boysenberry is the long-time cooking favorite, best in boysenberry pies and in cobblers and in fruit salads. This blackberry, I'm not sure what it is. It's a little bit on the tart side, and I think it's one of those berries that made the Indians frown years and years ago.
So now some of these berries are native, some are been introduced, some are crossed with things. Do you know the origins?
Blackberry is very old. I think it's a very old blackberry. Almost an heirloom. Probably was here when Columbus discovered the country.
And how did you come to plant them? Did you get the seeds or the canes?
The fellow that sold me this blackberry plant told me it was a Texas redberry, and now I know he was a liar because it has nothing to do with being red.
So you started your patch with just a few plants? Mm-hmm.
They were on the neighbor's property, and a few of them spread under the fence and came on my property, and I started my patch from those starts.
And when you say you start a patch, you just kind of let them go wild?
Yes.
Or you try to make them go in rows or anything?
Yes. Well, we put them in rows after they crawl under the fence because you want to be able to pick them. You want them up high so you can pick without bending over so far.
Okay, and then how long are you going to be in coming into the Wednesday market with all these berries?
Most 4 or 5 weeks.
Okay, just that.
This will be my son coming in.
All right, and then you guys do all the picking yourselves. I know it's very labor intensive.
We try to con people into doing it. We usually twist arms of relatives.
And they last about maybe one day, and then they say, never again.
Right. But we never see them.
And they like the heat, so you're literally out there in the high heat picking these things.
But this is ideal. So far this year, this is ideal weather. It's been 80, 85, maybe high 80s, which is perfect for ripening the berries. It gives them good sugar content.
Do you go to any other markets, Robert, where people can find these berries?
I think my son may be doing the Sunday Hollywood market.
Okay, possibly Sunday Hollywood and then Wednesday Santa Monica. Well, Robert, it's so great to have you back. People were asking. They ask for you by name toward the end of May. They all start wondering where you are, so we're so glad you're back.
I'm glad I'm still alive and can still come in.
So are we. And thanks again for the great berries.
Thank you.
That was Robert Poole, and he comes in once a year with his wonderful loganberries, youngberries, and boysenberries, and the blackberry. They're very unique, and he's a big favorite here at the Wednesday market, and we're glad he's here. So come on down and get him while you can. We're visiting now with Amelia Salzman, who's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, one of our favorite market shoppers and friends. And Amelia is here today shopping as usual when she's in town. And share with us, I know you've got a cart full of goodies, and you're going to be cooking something probably from your book that's seasonal and inspired. So why don't you give us a great recipe we can use right now?
It's cherry season, and we've only got cherries for about a month. They're just booming everywhere. And we're all busy eating them out of hand, but you know what? They're great as a savory salad. This was an idea I got from a 1911 LA Times cookbook. Just take, like, I don't know, 3/4 of a pound of mixed cherries. You've got the wonderful yellow Rainiers. You've got the bright Bings and the Brooks cherries. And also maybe get about 1/4 cup of dried cherries. And then some greens, and if you can get some bitter greens, either an arugula or frise or an escarole, these make a great counterpoint, their pepperiness to the sweet cherry. So all you're going to do is pit the cherries and toss them in a salad bowl with the dried cherries, with the peppery greens, and zest a lemon over that, and toast some almonds. Almonds and cherries go great together. If you have almond oil, that would be great. But if you don't, just a tablespoon or so of a light fruity olive oil would be fine. And just toss that up with some salt and pepper. It is a beautiful, beautiful salad. And then the finishing touch, get a nice piece of creamy white goat cheese. So you've got this sort of creamy, salty thing going on against the sweet cherries and the peppery greens. It's fabulous. Who thinks to have cherries as a savory dish?
It sounds so good. And are the almonds toasted and slivered?
I think in a salad, anytime you're using almonds in that way, I think they're always better toasted because it brings out all their flavors. And basically the way you do that is preheat an oven to 350 degrees and put the almonds in, like on a sheet pan, until they become fragrant. In other words, all those oils are sort of developing their flavors, and that's the point, right? It'll take about maybe 5-10 minutes at the most, and let them cool completely, then roughly chop them.
Okay, and to pit the cherries without a cherry pitter, you really need to go get that little device. There's only one way to do it.
Well, you know, that's true, but I did just hear of a very clever idea that I'm going to go home, right home and try, which is to try to poke it out with a chopstick. Just
oh, okay.
So I'll report back.
All right, well, as usual, inspiration, and the chopstick is a great idea. Can't wait
well,
to try that.
I'll let you know.
All righty, all right. Well, thanks so much, Amelia, as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook, and she is a regular shopper here at the market, contributes, of course, to the show, and we always love catching up with Amelia and getting inspired about the market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you haven't yet taken a look, I hope you'll go to kcrw.com/goodfood to view my latest video. In it, I show you a delicious spring vegetable sauté that you can always use in any season. Spot prawns are in season now, and LA Times writer Russ Parsons will give us a great way to eat these at home. I'll be right back with Russ when Good Food continues on KCRW and kcrw.com. We've been hearing a lot lately that we should be eating fish farther down on the food chain or fish that's local. So the spot prawn comes to mind. We've had conversations recently with Michael Cimaresti about the spot prawn, and now to give his opinion is Russ Parsons, food writer and journalist. Of course, you can read him all the time in the Los Angeles Times, and he's the author of the best-selling How to Read a French Fry, which was a winner of multiple James Beard Awards, and, of course, of his newer book, How to Pick a Peach, which I just noticed is out in paperback.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for noticing.
Hi, Russ. So let's talk about the spot prawn, and I guess my first question would be, the fact that it's called a prawn and not a shrimp, what does that mean? Does it have a meaning?
Do you want to talk as a foodie or do you want to talk as a scientist? Because it's like a tomato. You know, we talk about tomatoes being a vegetable, but, you know, tomatoes, of course, are fruits because they contain seeds, just like zucchini is a fruit or eggplant is a fruit. But because we're cooks, we think of fruits as being something sweet. It's the same kind of thing when you talk about prawns and about shrimp, because we refer to any kind of crustacean that's large as a prawn. In reality, a spot prawn is a shrimp, but do you remember that we used to be able to get those little ridgeback shrimps that were just delicious? Those are actually prawns. We called it a shrimp because it was small. We called the spot prawn a prawn because it's big. You know, when you're dividing things the way the scientists do, it has to do with how their shells are arranged is what the real division between a prawn
like
and
like what
a,
they're wearing?
Yes, what they're wearing.
Where is it fished from?
They're fished all up and down the West Coast. I mean, there's a big fishery in Alaska. There's some in Washington. There's some in Oregon. There's some in Northern California. But down here, the stuff that we get, most of it comes from from Southern California. At this point, there are only something like 30 boats in California that are licensed to catch them, and 20 or 25 of them operate from Santa Barbara to San Diego. So the vast majority of them come out of the Santa Barbara Channel.
And do they end up mostly in local markets, or are they frozen and shipped far away?
They do get shipped. 95% of the spot prawns are sold alive, you know, in Chinese markets in live tanks.
Now, why is
that? Or someplace like Fish King. The reason is because, like certain other crustaceans, within the head of the shrimp is a sac containing an enzyme. They call it the hepatopancreas. When the shrimp dies, that sac becomes permeable and the enzyme goes through the shrimp and turns the flesh mushy very quickly. So they have to be, you know, they have to be sold alive, or they have to be headed and frozen immediately while they're at sea. And since a lot of these boats are, that are catching them are small boats, they're not really set up for that. I went out with a spot prawn fisherman. Fisherman's probably kind of the wrong term because, you know, it's not like casting a line or anything like
that.
That's
not
how they
catch.
No, they catch them in traps. They used to catch them with big nets, but because those nets also brought up lots of other fish, including rockfish, which are protected, they completely eliminated the net fishery, with only a very few minor exceptions.
Are they like lobster traps or crab traps, but smaller?
It's like a crab trap. The opening is smaller. The trap's not smaller. And the thing that you have to know about these spot prawns is that they live at tremendous depth. Spot prawns are found usually between 600 and 1,000 feet deep.
Wow.
So it's like right at the edge of the continental shelf, or like at the canyons, or where there's cracks in the continental shelf. So these guys, the fishermen, they'll have strings that are about 3,000 feet long of traps, with maybe 10 traps, or on a bigger boat, 25 or 30 traps. And then they'll drop them off, and then they come back the next day, and they pick them up, or 2 days, and pick them up. One of the things I really loved about it, the best bait for spot prawns is Frisky's salmon dinner cat food. Because traditionally they use things like chum, you know, they chopped up fish. But when they put in too many chopped up fish, the octopuses come in and fill up the traps. And if there's octopuses in their traps, because octopuses eat spot prawns, the spot prawns won't go in the trap. And the ones that do won't last very long.
That is hysterical. Why are they called spot prawns?
Because they're really, really beautiful shrimp. They have, they're almost luminescent. Kind of this very pale orange, but there are four spots on either side.
If we were going to go to a Chinese market and see them, like at 99 Ranch, typically how old are they?
99 Ranch, and like the Asian chains like that, they are probably getting a lot of them that come in from Alaska because it's a big fishery, and they tend to be a little bit smaller. You know, the ones that I bought at 99 Ranch, I'd say they're probably 10 to 12 to a pound. The ones that we get down here are often much bigger, even like 4 to 6 to a pound. If you want the local ones, the best place to go, great people, there's a place in Newport Harbor called Pearson's Port. I mean, it's literally mom and pop. I mean, it looks just like a shack at the end of a short pier. But the husband is a guy named Tommy Pearson. The wife is a woman named Therese Pearson. Tommy does the fishing. Therese does the selling. And the inside of it is ringed by live tanks. And in the fall and winter, it'll be full of spiny lobsters because he's also a lobster fisherman. In the spring and summer, it's spot prawns. I don't think you'll ever find more than 6 types of fish in there because it's just, it's very controlled. But what you'll find is going to be really, really good, and it's going to be local.
So what do you like to do with them?
My favorite thing is the salt roasting. I rolled them in a spice mixture, kind of a spicy paste with a lot of red pepper and black pepper, some garlic. And then I laid them out on a cookie sheet on a bed of salt that had just been barely moistened, and then put another layer of salt over the top of that, and then baked it at 400 degrees. I think it was about 15 minutes, something like that.
Were they in the shells?
They head on in the shell, the whole thing.
So they were still alive?
So they were still alive. Yeah, boy, yeah. If they're going to die, they ought to die in butter or die some way that they're going to be appreciated.
Do you ever take the heads off and take the carapace off and then saute them?
I think shrimp is a lot better when it's cooked with the head on. You know, what we call the head of the shrimp is really just the main part of the body. That's where all the organs are. And there's a lot of fat in that. So when you cook them head on, that fat melts and it keeps the meat moist.
That was great. Thank you so much, Russ.
Thanks for having me on.
Russ Parsons writes for the LA Times food section, and he's also the author of the popular How to Eat a Peach. If you want his recipes, go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find them. In the late 50s and early 60s, no one in this country really knew what Mexican food was, certainly not authentic Mexican food. British writer Diana Kennedy changed all of that. She moved to Mexico and set about cataloging each region's special flavors. I caught up with her on her recent visit to L.A. I'll introduce you to her next when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. I remember the first time I held Diana Kennedy's The Art of Mexican Cooking in my hands. I had such anticipation and excitement, knowing that there were months of her sure hand and definite opinions to guide me in the kitchen. With her classic work, The Art of Mexican Cooking, in re-release, it's once again time for a conversation with the great lady. One of the beauties of Diana Kennedy, for those of us who remember when we first started hearing about you and reading your books, was that you showed us that there was an incredibly wonderful and diverse culinary tradition in Mexico, just as there is in France or Italy or China. What do you see in terms of what you see us cooking here in America and also in Mexico? Do you see more regional cooking happening?
Yes, I do. I see it happening in the States, in the U.S. And I must say, we have to hand it to many young chefs and restaurant owners in the States who are looking for new seasonings and becoming more and more curious about the different areas of Mexico. So I think that through them, it's a sort of catalyst, and it may make the Mexicans up here think more about their roots and want to retain it.
What are some of your Mexican pet peeves about food? What's the worst sort of nouveau fusion dish that you've had recently?
I think this lack of taking the skin off things, not cooking things with the bone and the skin, getting real flavors. That's one of my great peeves in this country. And the, of course, as in many parts of Mexico, these horrible tortillas that aren't real corn. I mean, well, it's corn originally, but made into the powder. And I think people are losing the taste for this real corn tortilla. And it's a great pity. It doesn't act properly in dishes like, if you were doing a casserole of, like the budines, as they call them, of tortillas, or if you were doing chilaquiles, they fall apart.
Now, what region do you live in?
Michoacán.
What is your favorite Michoacán dish?
I love the very, very delicate little fresh tamales called uchepos, and they're served with tomato sauce, broiled tomatoes, just with a bit of garlic, that's all, and a strip of cheese that will melt nicely, and some cream. And that's a wonderful first course. And in the north, I love also the, this is going to send you all into a tizzy, a barbecued head. In my area, it's near where the monarch butterflies come, they will wrap the head of an ox or a cow into pincers of maguey and put it in the oven overnight. And it's just so succulent and so wonderful, and I can't understand people who sort of turn up their noses at these things. And it's just delicious. And you serve it with a great corn tortilla and a wonderful sauce. And, to me, that's great food.
And during this time that you're spending in the States giving cooking classes, what are some of the dishes that you're sharing with people?
I'm doing a very nice sopa de albóndigas, and to make very tiny little meatballs. And they will have pork and beef, a little cumin, and little bits of chicharron in it, crumbled, to make them nice and spongy. I'm also from the northern part of my state, where the first dairy cows were introduced by the Spaniards. They have a lot of creamy, cheesy dishes. So one is called Minguiche, and it's green sauce with chili poblanos in it, and then you put little tortilla bits into it and cook those, and then you have cream and cheese on top and serve it as a sort of, we serve it as a dip or in a tortilla. That is absolutely unctuous and fabulous.
I am so hungry right now. Diana, you have been delightful. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I really look forward to it.
Some recipes from Diana Kennedy's recently republished seminal work, The Art of Mexican Cooking, are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, I hate to follow the respected Diana Kennedy with this next tale, but you'll see this footnote of odd food culture doesn't really fit in anywhere. When Good Food returns, I'll tell you about the sour toe cocktail. The special ingredient? You guessed it. A real preserved human toe. I know it's gross. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. You can find a lot of very strange food challenges on the web, but I have to say a sour toe cocktail may be the most extreme I've seen in a while. Perhaps it will even give our deep end diner pause. If you want an adventure, just head north to the Yukon, where you can challenge your courage and your intestinal fortitude with a sour toe cocktail at the Downtown Hotel in Dawson City, Yukon. The proprietor, Dick Van Nostrand, is here with me this morning. Okay, so when I hear the words sour toe cocktail, I imagine a toe in a drink. Is that...
That's exactly what it is. It's a petrified big toe.
It's a real toe.
A gnarly big toe.
A real toe. Okay. Are they preserved in some way or nuked within an inch of their lives so to make them palatable?
Well, they're initially preserved, of course, from the time that they're removed through a secretive process, which is basically petrifying them. And then they are, when they're not in pure alcohol in a drink, then they're kept in pickling salts to keep them dried out.
What color are they?
Well, after they've been through quite a few drinks, they get fairly dark. They're fairly dark brown.
So they look extremely bruised? Or do they look like a log, a piece of wood?
Yeah, they look like a bit of a log. But the most popular one that we have is, it has a pretty big nail on it, and it's pretty gnarly. So you wouldn't be mistaking it for a piece of wood.
You just said the most popular one you have. So you have toes that people actually ask for?
We have two toes that we kind of circulate in and out of use just to keep them so they don't end up getting soft at all.
Oh, gosh, a soft toe. That would be worse than a petrified toe.
You don't put the toe in your mouth. The toe goes into a straight shot of alcohol. You know,
what kind of alcohol?
Well, rye. One of the most popular things is Yukon Jack, which is basically only available up here. And it's a type of rum. But you know, like vodka, gin, rye, scotch, anything. And then the toe. Just the whole history of it is that the toe must touch your lips. You can drink the drink fast or you can drink it slow, but the toe must touch your lips, and the captain must witness that.
And you are the captain.
I am the captain sometimes. We have to...
Sometimes you deputize others.
Well, in the summertime, I have other parts of the business to take care of.
Tell me the story behind the sour toe cocktail.
Well, Captain Dick Stevenson was a riverboat captain on the Yukon River for many years. Later on in his career, he decided that he needed some place to be able to get away in the summertime and found out about a cabin upriver on the Yukon River. So he made arrangements to purchase it and took some buddies downriver to kind of clean the cabin up and get it ready to go so they could use it for that summer. And when they got into the cabin to start their work, one of the things they found was a quartz sealer jar with this petrified toe lying in the bottom of it. And they had heard the story that the fellow that owned the cabin had suffered from frostbite one winter, and they had heard that he had maybe ended up cutting off his big toe to save himself from impending gangrene. And they grabbed the toe, and they proceeded to go to a local bar and sit down, and here they've got this toe, and there's a little bit of talk about how Alaska has these ice worms, and now you've got this toe, so why don't you just try that drink and throw that toe into it? And that's where it was born.
Oh, my goodness.
Ripley's has been up here to film it, and it's pretty famous worldwide.
And has the health department?
We had it, 8 or 10 years ago. One of the health department people from one of the other jurisdictions found out about it, and they decided that they would get officious, as those people sometimes like to do, and decided that they would challenge the whole thing, and that just didn't go anywhere. There's absolutely no issues with it at all.
Does a toe have a natural life as a cocktail accoutrement, or do you have to occasionally get a new toe, and if so, where does it come from?
Well, I can't imagine that they would outlive their natural life. The problem is that we've had macho dudes chew them up. We've had them mistakenly thrown out by bartenders that haven't been paying attention. So we have gone over the years. We have gone through a few toes, and we are we're always looking in need of some backup toes. We've had people that are members of the club who have emailed us and said, you know, I've put you in my will so that when I die that you're going to be able to get my big toe. And so we are in some people's wills. We haven't gotten any of those yet, but we've just...
Perhaps this story will lead you to a new source of toes.
Well, that's what we need.
Now, I understand for those of us who might not want to go there, you have an option that's a suite.
Well, we took the toe down to Vancouver quite a few years ago and had a premium chocolate-making company down in Vancouver do a mold of the toe. And so we have dark Belgian chocolate toes.
Oh, I love that. That's like a foot fetishist's dream.
Yeah, there you go.
Dick, it has been very much fun talking with you. Thank you.
You too.
Dick Van Nostrand runs the bar at the Downtown Hotel at Dawson City, Yukon. Look at the toe if you dare at kcrw.com/goodfood. Let's raise the bar a bit, from sour toes to champagne. Champagne prices are going up and up, just like everything else. The weak dollar's making it tough to enjoy the bubbly, but in times of challenge comes opportunity. I'll be back to talk about alternatives you may not have heard of before. Stick around. Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com will be right back. There's nothing like sparkling wine. Nothing. Its bubbly effervescence celebrates our major milestones unlike any other drink. But something's percolating in the economics of real champagne, so it's time to take another look at those bubblies that can't be called champagne. George Cassette, one of the principals at Silver Lake Wine here on the east side of L.A., joins us this morning for an enlightening session on that most festive of all beverages. So I would only imagine that in the world of champagne, the weak dollar and the strong euro is coming home to roost in a scary way.
Yeah, a lot of the problem, obviously, is the ratio between the dollar and the euro, and also demand elsewhere. I think, as I understand, China is now wanting a big hunk of champagne. And as you remember, probably I don't know, a few months ago, there was an article in the Times about Champagne wanting to expand its borders, you know, I mean, which is, it's Champagne.
Meaning what?
Meaning they would make the region larger so that we could call some stuff that is not now Champagne, Champagne. And of course,
that just seems like so opportunistic of these effete French people who for so many years probably wanted to make it smaller.
Well, the thing about Champagne that you have to realize is that it's one of the most amazing instances of branding in the history of sales. We don't use the big houses that much. People ask for Dom Pérignon, and I can say, hopefully without sounding too snotty, well, they are selling it down at CVS, which they really are. I mean, I walked in there one time around Christmas, and there was bottles of Dom Pérignon. So
how scary is that?
It might be good, but it's not exclusive. If that, you know, people kind of are looking for exclusivity with champagne.
So in terms of French champagne prices right now, what is the range?
Well, there's one champagne that we have had, and we haven't had it for a little while, so I don't want to say the name, but we were able to get it in at under $30. But I will interject that there were certain champagnes, and again, which shall remain nameless, that when we opened 4.5 years ago were $40, $45 a bottle, which are now $65 to $70 a bottle, the exact same champagne. And that is where people freak out. to use a technical wine term.
So let's go back to this idea of sparkling wines that don't come from Champagne.
Okay.
Where can we see some interesting possibilities for our palate?
Well, there are things domestically. We carry the Gruet sparklers from New Mexico. People always kind of do a double take about that, but they're really quite good. And I think they're right around 15, and then their second label, 11, respectively. We have one wine that really shines, and it's gone up maybe a buck or two over the past 3 or 4 years, but, you know, it's still at under $14. And it's from an area called Limoux. It's in the southwestern part of France. It was the first region to produce sparkling wine as such, predating Champagne. And so while the guys in Champagne were still trying to figure out how to get the bubbles out of that stuff, these guys were making sparkling wine. And I think that wine, there's a grape called Mozac. The producer is called Domaine J. Lawrence, L-A-U-R-E-N-S. And they make a really kind of stunning bottle of sparkling wine that I would guess 90% of the people would not be able to tell the difference between that and a bottle of champagne.
And what's the price point for that?
That, I believe, my number memory is not good, but I think it's $13.75. That includes tax.
And what about products coming from Spain or Portugal?
Lots of good things in Spain. Cava is the wine there, one that I recently tried that we'd had before, and I really forgot how good it was. It's Jouvet y Camps. C-A-M-P-S, and they grow all their own grapes. They're in Penedès, which is just a little south of Barcelona. I think they are certified organic as well now. That's what I recall. And those wines have a lot of character. They have big flavors. I would say the champagne aficionado would say they may lack finesse, but they certainly don't lack joy, I think. The Germans and the Austrians have Sekt, which people will be a little afraid of because it'll be made from Riesling. It'll say on it, if it says trocken, it's dry. Those are great. S-E-K-T, although I recall visiting a friend in Berlin, and we were in a big department store, Kadive, and she pronounced loudly, "Since I've been in Germany, I have had some great Sekts." And we had some, we had the wine, Prosecco from Italy. And I've heard rumor of such things as $100 Proseccos.
Really?
In Italy, yeah. I've never tried one of those. I've tasted some that were kind of expensive and thought they weren't really there. But I hold the option open to taste a great Prosecco.
George Cassette is from Silver Lake Wine, a great place to learn about wines. They have tastings each Sunday as well as Thursday night flight tastings. I've got a list of what George mentioned at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're a fan of food television, you'll know of Sarah Moulton. She's the executive chef at Gourmet Magazine and is able to talk busy people through home cooking conundrums on her TV shows on the Food Network. When Good Food returns, she and I will tackle the problem of cooking at home during the week. That's coming up in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. It's time to celebrate because the lovely Sarah Moulton is back on PBS with a new show, Sarah's Weeknight Meals. The reason we're in celebratory mode is that Sarah is the real deal when it comes to a television chef teaching you how to cook food. Because she's not just a television chef. She's been the executive chef of Gourmet for a really long time. And she's also the food editor for ABC TV's Good Morning America. For weeknight meals, what do you think is the most important thing that people have in order to be able to effectively cook night after night after night? Is the secret to have a great pantry?
Well, that's part of it. What I would say really in a nutshell is a plan. Have a plan. I mean, if you get out of work at 5 or 6 and then go to the grocery store and start thinking about dinner, it just isn't going to happen. I mean, I'd eat takeout, too, or fast food if that's how I set myself up. So on weekends, I really sit down and try to plan out the week. So that's part of it. You're absolutely right about the pantry. A great pantry, you know, you could have like 2 or 3 meals just lurking in your pantry for when you didn't have any other plans. But the other thing is an imagination. So many people think in this country that they have to have the traditional sort of protein, starch, vegetable. And if you sort of throw that up and completely forget about it, you can have so much more fun. So why not have breakfast for dinner or soup for supper or a substantial sandwich? And that's some of the stuff I tried to do on the show.
Well, I have to say, I really do love having breakfast for dinner. So what are some of your favorite things to make?
Well, my stuff is mostly egg-based, I have to say, because I'm an eggaholic, let's face it. So I have this wonderful dish, which is eggs baked in ham cups with sofrito, you know, that nice Latin mix of vegetables, which is onions, garlic, peppers, cilantro, and tomato. And so you sort of chop all that up, take a thin slice of ham, throw it into a muffin tin, put some of that mixture in there, break an egg on top, throw on some Monterey Jack cheese and bake it off, and it's done in 20 minutes. And two of those little packages is dinner. You can use low-fat cheese to lighten it up, but other than that and the fat and the yolk of the egg, it's pretty lean.
It sounds really delicious. There's something so comforting about breakfast for dinner.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, and then I have a bunch of other egg dishes, but I also have like a homemade knish that's pretty substantial.
Now, for those people who don't know what a knish is, could you describe it?
I forget you're on the West Coast, right? I'm in New York here. A knish is this amazing sort of potato-based, heavy hockey puck but delicious item that you get in delis in New York City. And you can have, you know, spinach or kasha or any kind of vegetable in there.
So do you recommend that people go out and buy a knish?
Oh, no, no, no. You make your own. It's very simple dough, sort of like a lean pastry dough, like a pot brisée, but very lean. And you just roll that out and wrap the thing in there. most of the recipes are only about 20 minutes of your time.
I want to go back to the pantry for a minute, though. Some people might have things in their pantry which aren't the things that maybe you and I think are excellent pantry items.
Right.
So what are some key pantry or fridge ingredients that we should pretty much always have on hand?
Well, obviously pasta, first and foremost. I'm so glad the anti-carb police went bye-bye, because that was stupid. Because if you throw a ton of vegetables into a pasta dish, you're just doing so well anyway.
Yeah, and actually you're lowering the glycemic load of the pasta.
Absolutely. So pasta, first and foremost, many different shapes and sizes, rices and grains. Because a lot of times what I'll do, and these days, given the economic situation in this country, I do this more and more, I'll make a dish that's based on a starch, meaning a pasta or a rice or a grain, and just sort of embellished with a bunch of vegetables on top. So I do fried rice, but it's not really fried like in a lot of oil. I do that all the time and just empty out the refrigerator and everything I've got in there. But I start with a base of starch or potato, something like that, and then I build on it with some protein, but more as a flavoring, and then some vegetables. So other items you should have are beautiful bottled tomatoes or tomato sauce, artichoke hearts, olives. I mean, you actually could list all of this. This is right up your alley. All the Italian things are just so great in the pantry. And then, of course, you should always have onions and garlic. You should always have some kind of potatoes, sweet potatoes as well. And then in the fridge, I always have cheddar and Parmesan for sure. I always have eggs because eggs, as I said, can make a great meal. And then don't tell anybody, but I love Hellmann's mayonnaise. So I use that as a secret ingredient.
And out here on the West Coast, it's called Best Foods.
Best Foods, exactly right. And then Dijon mustard. Lots of good, different kinds of oils and vinegars also really help to sort of dress up whatever else you've got going.
You mentioned that you use mayonnaise as a secret ingredient. How do you use it secretly?
Well, I use it as a glue if I want to make some sort of pork chop and put a coating on top of it, a crumb coating. I'll mix mayonnaise with some mustard and then put some crumbs on top. It helps it to adhere, and it actually has a nice flavor. Or I'll use it as a dipping sauce because you just thin it down with a little lemon juice. And then, for example, I'll take chopped up Kalamata olives and throw that into some mayonnaise. Or I'll cut it with buttermilk. I mean, one of the things that I like to do, I love ranch dressing. Now my true colors are showing. So I'll make a homemade one with low-fat mayonnaise and some buttermilk and then throw in some garlic and fresh herbs, and it's just delicious.
Leave us with a substantial sandwich idea for dinner.
Wow, I just made one last night. And you're going to laugh because there's no such thing as a Mexican meatball sub. But what the heck? It's made with turkey, I thought. I'll do it with turkey just to keep it a little leaner. And you add the usual suspects. First, well, turkey tends to be a little lean, so I saute up some onion and garlic and then cool it off quick in the freezer. Throw it in the freezer because you don't want to add hot vegetables to your ground meat. And then I add that and some cumin and some oregano to some meatballs with a little salt. I shape them and brown them. And to that pan, I add 1 cup of store-bought salsa or your own homemade, 1 cup of tomato sauce, 1/2 or 1 chipotle and adobo chopped fine. So it's about 1.5 tablespoons. And, 1/2 cup of beer, because alcohol adds flavor. And so then you brown the meatballs, add all those liquids, put the lid on, simmer it for 20 minutes, take the lid off, let it simmer down a little bit so the sauce gets thickened, and then you put it on really good bread. And
wow,
boy, is it
that
good.
Sounds
my
so
boys
good.
Loved me. Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. It has nothing to do with reality. There is no such thing as a Mexican meatball. They certainly wouldn't make it with turkey, and they wouldn't put it on bread. But so what? That's what I mean, having fun.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Sarah's Secrets for Weeknight Meals is Sarah's latest book and PBS show. She's the executive chef at Gourmet Magazine and hosts a cooking show on the Food Network. Recipes from Sarah are available at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of secrets, I've got one for making great pie crust. It's coming up next with America's Test Kitchen contributor, Jack Bishop. That's when Good Food continues on KCRW and kcrw.com. There's something about summer fruits once they come into the marketplace that makes you just want to go into your kitchen and bake a pie or a cobbler or a crisp or some other delicious thing, maybe a pound cake topped with fruit. With me this morning is Jack Bishop. He's here representing America's Test Kitchen. They have a book coming out that is the America's Test Kitchen Family Baking Book. It's a companion to their big family cookbook they came out with just a little while ago. And it's one of these books that you just open it up to any page, and it's some yummy, comforting, wonderful bit of baked Americana. So let's start with pie, since that's like the total iconic, for me, the iconic summer dessert. My birthday happens to be in July, and my entire life, well, since I was conscious, I never had a birthday cake. I always have a birthday pie.
My birthday's in July. Mine was blueberry pie.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, so what was your iconic birthday pie?
Well, boysenberry when we can get them. Boysenberries. Wow. I love them. Now, people get hysterical when told to make a pie crust, even though once you learn, and like you said, so much of it is knowing how it feels. Once you learn, it's so easy and it feels so good to roll it out. It makes you feel very competent. What are some techniques, some sort of handy hints for pie crust that you can give us?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for pie crust is that if you add too much water to it, the dough is tough. I mean, you get the gluten to develop. The more liquid that it's, the water that's added with the flour, the proteins form, and you get, instead of a sort of tender, flaky crust, you get a sort of tough crust. And everybody's had a pie with a tough crust where you're really having to sort of push through the crust with your fork. So the inclination may be to put less water in, but then the pie dough is really hard to roll out and really hard to handle, and it's tearing and it's cracking and you're patching it together. So we, one of our test cooks came up with this idea of you need moisture, but water is the problem. And so he replaced half of the water with vodka. And the great thing about the vodka is the dough is plenty moist and easy to roll out, but the vodka evaporates in the oven and the alcohol that's in vodka does not react with the flour to form gluten. And so you get all the benefits of making a pie dough that has a lot of moisture in it in the sense that it's easy to roll out, but none of the downside of that liquid forming gluten and no toughness. And
that's incredible. So if I take my sort of pie recipe, which I use, which is two parts flour, one part fat, and then half a part liquid, then I can take that half a part liquid and do a quarter water and a quarter vodka?
Right.
That's genius.
And the vodka is about 60% alcohol. So it is adding some water, but all of the portion that's alcohol really has no effect on gluten development. And the alcohol evaporates. Vodka is tasteless. The crust, you really can't taste that the crust was made with vodka. And it's just a sort of brilliant idea.
Now, when I was a kid, I had a mother who was a marvelous entertainer, but she really didn't have time. She was a single mom. She didn't really have time to spend in the kitchen doing a lot of baking. And one of our favorite desserts was like a shortcake. But instead of using a biscuit or whatever, she would do it with a bought pound cake. And I discovered that pound cake is not easy to make.
No, the problem with pound cake, it's a very old recipe. It goes back centuries. It predates chemical leaveners. And really all the leavening in pound cake in a traditional recipe is coming from the creaming of the butter with the sugar and then the very gradual beating in of the eggs. There's a lot of eggs in pound cake, usually probably about 4 eggs in a regular pound cake. And if you don't have the temperatures of those ingredients just right, the batter will curdle. The butter really won't get the creaming that it needs, and so that you come up with, you know, a brick, that sort of leaden pound cake. You know, it may taste okay from a sort of flavor point of view, but it is dense, heavy pound cake. And so we developed a recipe where we got around all this and used because what you're really trying to do is it's almost like making mayonnaise. You're adding the eggs to fat, the butter in this case, in very sort of slow form and trying to get it to emulsify. And sort of reversed this, did it with melted butter in a food processor and sort of drizzled in the melted butter into the food processor where we had already whipped the eggs and sugar, drizzled in the melted butter like you were making mayonnaise almost. Instead of adding oil, adding melted butter. You get a perfect emulsified batter, and it is just goof-proof.
Share with me another lovely recipe that you really had fun with.
One of my favorites was an old-fashioned chocolate layer cake. And the cook who worked on this actually made 130 cakes over the course of 2 months. At the end of every day,
I can't. You guys are crazy.
We almost sent him, I think, over the edge. At the end
so
of
does that mean every day you sit down to chocolate cake?
Yes. I mean, we have an intercom system in the office. And so when food is ready, the intercom comes off and says, chocolate cake down in the kitchen. And, you know, and everyone who is on the team is supposed to go down and taste. And, you know, at the end of every day, because he was sort of baking all day, and then at 4, 4:30, he'd have his, you know, daily showing of 2, 3, 4, 5, however many cakes he'd made that day. And they were all good. But the biggest problem was they didn't have enough chocolate flavor. And in his research, he found in some turn-of-the-century cookbooks this notion of making what was called a chocolate pudding, where they cooked the unsweetened chocolate, the cocoa, the sugar, and the water, and sort of cook them on the stovetop. There's some sort of chemical breaking down of the chocolate. You really sort of bloom the flavor of the chocolate. You cool that mixture, but that's instead of just melting the chocolate, by adding it with the water and the sugar, the cocoa solids really change and their flavor becomes much more pronounced.
Thank you, Jack. Now you've totally inspired me to get back into the kitchen for some good summer baking. Jack Bishop is editorial director of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country Magazines. He's a cast member of Public Television's The America's Test Kitchen. I've got a recipe for you from the America's Test Kitchen Family Baking Book at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, of course, food serves a number of purposes for us. It nourishes us. It also gives us a pat on the back after a good job, a kiss on the cheek after a hard day, and solace when we're really sad. It's what we call comfort food. Next, comfort food from a woman who built her restaurant around the concept. That's when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. After knocking around the food scene in Southern California for a few decades, you really get a sense of who the long-term heavyweights are. You know, those people who are talented, work hard, give back, and create a lot of pleasure for others. Zav Karamardian is the owner of Zav's Restaurants, and she has restaurants and or bakery cafes in Tustin, Newport, and Irvine. She's definitely a heavyweight. And she's a queen of comfort food and the author of a new book, Zav, Recipes and Memories from the Heart. What are some of the meals that for you personally are comforting?
Well, to me, what comfort food means is the memories of the past. When you're young, coming home from school, walking in the house, at least in our time. To me, when you're very, very hungry, the first thing you can think of is something from your childhood, be it a meatloaf, be it a chicken pot pie or a spaghetti or anything that you remember having what your mom made.
Now, I understand that you have a pretty renowned meatloaf.
I love fresh herbs in my meatloaf. I use lots of thyme in there. I use a lot of rosemary, soaked bread, day-old bread that's soaked in a little bit of milk or cream, has a little bit of tomato paste. It has eggs and a lot of the herbs and parsley, of course. And I think that's what really makes a wonderful meatloaf. And, of course, when you're making a meatloaf, you don't want to overmix it. That's one of the fallacies of making meatloaf. It gets really tough. Also, another thing that I do is usually I remember when my mom used to make meatloaf is she used to put it in a pan, in a loaf pan. And I hated that water that accumulated on the bottom. So I create my meatloaf into loaves. You shape it into like 2.5 pound loaves. And then I coat it with some panko or breadcrumbs, whatever. And I just put it in the oven on a rack. And what happens is the juices just sort of wash out and you have this nice crispy brown meatloaf. And it cuts really well, too.
I'm really happy that I know I have some ground turkey at home that I can go make some meatloaf. Otherwise, I would be walking the street after this conversation. Now, did your mom teach you how to cook?
My mom is my inspiration on cooking. She had very few things that she made but they were great. But my inspiration has been Julia Child.
And I understand that you actually grew up to have a friendship with Julia.
Yes.
And that you have some pretty great stories.
Yeah. When I was young, in my early teens, I used to watch Julia on TV.
Yes, Evan. Oh, I absolutely
We all did,
did
the
yes.
same thing. So I used to follow Julia everywhere she went.
Whenever what do you mean?
She used to come to San Francisco, do a cooking classes. She used to go to Los Angeles. I used to come to L.A. I mean, she went everywhere around California. She used to do her book travels. And I used to, really, San Diego, I've been there so many times.
Did she think you were a stalker?
No, I never really approached her until I opened my restaurant. Then I joined, of course, the IACP, which is an international organization of culinary professionals. That's when I really got to know Julia better and one-to-one with her until her aunt, which I'm blessed to say she was my friend. We actually saw each other on a regular basis. And I've taken that meatloaf to her on many occasions. You know, she loved it.
So you must have shared a fair amount of casual meals with her.
Yes.
Give us some insight as to how she fed herself when she was basically no one was watching.
You know, one day, I will never forget one day, my friend Kathy Thomas and I went to visit her when she was sick. And we went to the hospital and they told us that she had gone. What happened? Oh, she went home for lunch. So we went home and there she was sitting on her little table there and she had her little cat next to her and she was having a tuna sandwich, a little potato chips, a little bowl of fruit, and here she was just like the rest of us. That's how she was, you know. And other times I've been there, she's had egg sandwiches and cornbread. She was a very simple person. Besides the French cooking, all of that, she taught us how to cook. But deep inside, she was really a very simple person.
So what do you think about how people are cooking today?
The lifestyle that we have today, we're almost prone to do that because we don't have time. I'm really glad to say most people are cooking well because they are going to the market. They are buying a piece of chicken. They're sauteing the chicken. The Food Network has been fantastic in educating our public. It's just knowing few techniques, getting that skillet hot, caramelize your fish or chicken or meat, whatever it is, finish it in the oven, putting a little bit of lemon juice or a little bit of chicken broth, a little bit of butter, and some herbs. There you have a sauce in the pan. It's not that difficult to do. So people are seeing that, and believe me, they're appreciating it more.
Zav is the chef and owner of Zav's Bistro and Zav's Cafe and Bakery. I'll have a recipe for her famous meatloaf at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, what's comforting to one person can be horrifying to another. I'd love to know what you eat when you really need that special emotional assistance. Go to the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood and let me know. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest video, download the show and past episodes online. kcrw.com/goodfood. Please write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I will absolutely write you back. And don't forget to check out our new blog. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.